I'm Dwayne Addison from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. In a moment, I want to say something more about myself and my own spiritual journey, which is under the way that's really a part of this course. For a number of sessions this week, we'll be talking about Native American spirituality. Much we could say, but the concern I have is how do we as Christians learn and receive from that? That's a two-way street, but I'm going to talk mainly, or at least my concern will be some of the things that we can learn. And I've broken this up into five packages. Normally I want to do things in four, because that's the sacred number for nearly all Native American traditions. And I can do it in any package, I can do it in a three-letter phrase. I'll talk about that later, that sort of summarizes all, or I could go on forever in the material that is here. But these are the themes. They're so put together that each one will speak about some of the same things, and so you're welcome to come to any or all of the sessions. And I hope that each one will have some new elements, some new insights. And I will share a bit, but the shape of the conversation is for you to share and to raise your questions and to make your contributions as well. Because it's our own spiritual journey that I'm really talking about. And that's the interest that I have in these things. Today, the concern that spirit is present. Let me ask a question, and then we'll begin by preparing ourselves for sharing. Are there any of you that have had, I don't even put the word significant, use your own judgment on this, experience with Native American peoples or dealing with the kinds of issues that we'll deal with this week? You may just sort of identify yourself or say that I'm going to invite you at appropriate points to share as well. Several of you. I really look forward to that. It may contradict, it may complement, it may move us in new directions, and I indeed would welcome that. Those of you who experience that, maybe those experiences are negative. Let us begin with silence. Spirit of God, give us eyes to see your marvelous creative and healing presence. Help us to learn from one another and give to witness to your power. Amen. I just think nothing to do with our topic. I think I have something in common with St. Paul. And my wife refers to it as my thorn in the flesh. And if you see me sort of blank out at a moment, I have a strange affliction, which we haven't discovered what it is yet. Without warning, I'll have a momentary spasm of pain in my right leg. And when it comes and when it goes, I don't know. Sometimes it's only a fraction of a second. Sometimes it lasts for several seconds. And at that moment, I would choose to scream or to move. And that seems to do it a little bit, but I think it just sort of goes away of its own accord. And I debated. My doctor looked me over and x-rayed me and said, we don't know what it is. It's something to do with your nerves. And that I didn't want to go any further because it might have prevented me from coming to Holden, you know, to run through tests. And for a couple of weeks it hasn't bothered me, but these past few days it's there. And so if I look odd or seem odd at a moment, recognize what it is and just sort of be patient. And St. Paul prayed for his to go away, and finally that got away. 16 years ago, our family moved to South Dakota. I had had no real contact with American Indian people, although I grew up in an area in southwest Minnesota where the history and the land was rich with history at that point. But shortly after I became there, for a variety of reasons, I got in contact with some of our students at Augustana College. We've always had a small number, but a continuing number that are there. Contact with Native American tribal people in the state of South Dakota, and we have many. And my concern that I came to this was with the issues of justice, of fair treatment with fellow citizens of our country. And I'd been working in black communities and the black experience, that had taught stuff in black studies before that, and so this is my entree. But with that concerned, I discovered very quickly a rich realm of experience and knowledge that was valuable for my understanding of the Christian faith itself. I became acquainted with some of our Indian students at Augustana College. They said, there's nothing here that talks about our heritage, our background. And I said, which I've done a number of times rather foolishly, okay, I'll teach a course. We have that option of doing things, just a seminar type thing. I'll bring in some guests and some resource materials and started with a seminar course on Plains Indian culture and religion. Not having training in anthropology and only a small amount in comparative religions, I did it. The course was self-taught. Indian students and a number of white students that were already into this sort of material, we got together. It became fairly popular, and a little later, you know, we put it into a regular course, and then the state of South Dakota required our teachers to be certified to have some knowledge of South Dakota Indian culture and history, and so it had to be adapted for a course for giving them information and knowledge. And so now, along with another Native American teacher in our faculty, was superb. We teach these certification courses. But my version of the course focuses upon Native American spirituality. And so since 1971, I've been doing this. That has opened so many doors, and I've been the one that sort of gained from this. I've worked with our South Dakota District of the American Lutheran Church, our national ALC. I've been working with the National Indian Lutheran Board, a gathering of people, Indians and non-Indians, who are concerned about the Lutheran Church's response to Indian concerns. And through that, I've become related to and working with a group called Native American Theological Association. This is a consortium of church agencies and institutions that is concerned with the development of leadership within the Christian Native American community. And that's a very exciting thing. The development of leadership, and the excitement there is in part of the new leadership that is coming forth that is indeed rich, but the kinds of themes that we're dealing with. Later this summer, I'll have a chance to spend a week. We've done that for several years now in the Black Hills of South Dakota in Native summer term. And we'll deal with concerns, these students that are preparing for ministry within the Native American community. And throughout the years now, since this has begun, I've gained a great number of friends, both quote-unquote traditional, that have gone back or remained with their traditional sorts of ways, and also with connections with Christian Native Americans. I comment, the Indian people in South Dakota, both institutionally and otherwise, are more Christian than the whites. Somebody counted that there are 105% of the Indians in South Dakota are Christian. There people like to count them, and they get counted several times. At least at that level it's there, but many other areas as well, because they have appropriated the Christian faith in a remarkable way. That's my background. And I want to set forth some concerns. Again, the concern that we'll have in these sessions is to enrich our Christian faith and life, what we can learn. And I've chosen to do it by just selecting, almost arbitrarily, we can make it packages in other ways, a variety of themes. Themes that are very broad, themes, as I understand them, that are quite common to a variety of Native American traditions. When I teach my courses in this area, the first thing I want to get across is be very careful, and at the beginning, in writing exam questions particularly, don't talk about the Indian, because there is no such creature, as there is no such creature as the white man. To beware of the individuality and the great diversity of traditions, particularly in the areas that we're dealing with now. But then I've chosen to take these themes that will be a way of focusing things that are much broader and much richer. There is my opening note that I give in my course at Augustana College. I would say it will take us a lifetime to learn the riches that are here. But also, one phrase captures it all. And when you begin to learn what that phrase means, you've really gotten to the heart of Native American spirituality. Three words. Respect for vision. That's what it's about. Have respect for another person's vision, another person's way of seeing. And the idea of vision will be a key idea. Vision can mean those sort of, what we would consider very exotic ways of seeing beings that are around us that we don't see with a normal eye. A personification of powers of nature around us. Or vision can be, in that ordinary sense, but very important sense, just our total way of seeing, apprehending what is around us. And that gets to the heart of the matter. And to be a genuine person is to respect the vision of another, to respect your own vision, to respect the vision of other people's. One of the remarkable recurring themes of the encounter between Indians and non-Indians, and very prominent in the plains, is the kind of respect that was given to holy persons. An exception to this, if you were in the wrong tribe here and you were identified with the Crow Indians and this Western Sioux came across you, you were one of the Crow and you were in trouble. They didn't see that at the moment, but missionaries, the black robe Catholics, Protestant missionaries, particularly this is true in the Plains Indians, but I see that pattern repeating elsewhere. At the first instance, were welcomed because they were seen, even though they were from an alien tradition, we might think, of being in touch with the powers, and they could share. And it didn't matter if that was from another community. They were there to teach you. And that is a part of that respect for vision. Today's theme, let me set forth some basic things that I would see, some suggestions of what we might appropriate. It will open up for discussion, but raise questions along the way. And I will be plugging some books. Let me do one of those right now, An Obligation for Mary, and I will do this along the way. So many books here, and you must move beyond books to deal with real people to learn this, but the books are introductions. For this theme, there's only one book that we have in the bookstore, another book that I suggested she was not able to get unless she bought by the hundreds, and I said, no, not wise to do that. But the one I recommend in the first book, if you have not read it, it is one of the great classics of all times and cultures. Black Elk Speaks, it's available in paperback. And I know this is sort of skewed to the Dakotas and the Plains, but wherever I read, where people reflect upon Native American spirituality, and books that come out now are largely dedicated to Black Elk and his visions. Black Elk, with a holy man of the Oglala Sioux, Western South Dakota. And the book here is, he didn't even know the English language. There's an interesting story about how the book came to be and how it became to be a classic. Just relates primarily his visions and experiences as a child and as a young man. And it allows us, in a remarkable and very poetic way, to enter into his experiences. It has value as a historical piece because it allows us to feel and to see what it was like to be on the other side at that 19th century encounter. It climaxes where, as a young man, he comes across the massacre at Wounded Knee 1 in 1890, although he does not relate the story until 1931. Is related through the process of his son, who translates, who is bilingual, Benjamin Black Elk. And then John Neihardt, who is a poet of great capacities, who is able to take this vision and to translate this into words, into images that are powerful for us. I tell my students, because very early in our course, after introductory material, we enter into the book, and I said, it's only about the third time through, because you're entering into a strange world in many ways, that you begin to get the real power and the messages that are there. many other books, but this is the one that is a do-it-yourself piece to enter into it. I would say, for me and for many, it has been one of the three or four great books that is life-changing and life-forming. Here are my books. Let me begin. Spirit is present. I'll refer to others along the way as sort of resources, but the dedication of seeing with a native eye. You may know Walter Capps. I think he's been here at the camp. He teaches the University of California the Santa Barbara symposium that they had there. In the introduction, this will relate some of the concerns we have. Dedicated to Black Elk's vision, that there are spirit shapes of things at the center of the world. It's the message I want to share this morning. His way of seeing is that there are spirit shapes of things at the center of the world. And to put it into Black Elk's own words, again, another book that we did not get, it takes another approach. It describes, which is a rare thing to do for a Native American person, that of traditional sort of orientation, to share the meaning of the most sacred rites or ceremonies. That'd be another approach that we could have here. And you're treading on holy ground, and you do it with care. But he felt it was a part of the fulfillment of his vision, finally to share these seven sacred rites with another great interpreter, Joseph Epes Brown, who is now at Missoula, Montana, is an interpreter, the vocation of interpreting Black Elk. And let me share these words with which he himself suggests that what he is doing and why. I've been told that it's been a long time since there's been peace in this world. That is, he's not aware of the English language, does not have the access, as he's doing this just a few months before his death in 1948, a very old man at the time. There's much talk of peace among the Christians. Black Elk, as he himself is a Christian, and this is reflected through these eyes, perhaps. Yet this seems to be just talk. Perhaps it may be. And this is my prayer, that through our sacred pipe, the title of the book, and through this book in which I shall explain what our pipe really is, peace may come to these peoples and to all peoples who can understand, an understanding which must be at the heart of the heart and not of the head alone. Then they might realize that we Indians know the one true God, and that we have prayed to him continually. I wish to make this book through no other desire than to help my people in an understanding of the greatness and truth of our own tradition, and also to help in bringing peace upon the earth, not only among men, but within men, pardon the sexist language, but this is before time, within men and between the whole of creation. The concern is to make peace. I had a delightful experience a number of years ago of lecturing in a Mennonite community of the peace testimony of Native American experience. And I used Black Elk, but there's much more there. Peace, indeed, is the purpose, the goal of spirituality. That's another dimension you might explore. Spirit is present. Let me make some affirmations on that, some suggestions, and to open up. What can we gain? I would suggest that the number one thing that I've learned in these readings, in these contacts with people, is an awareness of the presence of divine power in the midst of life. That's the heart of the vision. Or the more technical works will talk about that, the first sort of chapter, the first sort of thing here is to begin to talk about these for Western audiences and non-Indian audiences. Unseen powers that are around us. A book, very rich because it's one of a kind thus far, called The Sacred. You know, I am disappointed in most books about Native American religion because they have an outsider's view, and the teacher of the sacred is, it is almost totally perspectives of Native American people themselves, and much of it contemporary. There's a different tone in the book that you would have by anthropologists or scholars of religions many times. And they say that there are sort of seem to be about a half a dozen basic core realities that come again and again, no matter what tradition you come to in North America, of these traditional voices of traditional peoples. And the first one they announced is that unseen powers that are around us, the thing that I wish to lift up today. Despite the diversity and despite what I will say, we must speak about religions when we speak about it in a very accurate sense. A second affirmation that I've shared with our artist in residence, that I think this is true, I've been told it, and I know it's true in the Sioux people, or I'll use the term Lakota, that is the Western language division there. There seems to be no word for religion in Indian languages. And as I told Daryl, it also seems to be true there's no word for art. Maybe it's not such a big deal, because that seems to be a feature of what we call primitive societies. And I don't want to use that in all a negative sense, but societies that are much simpler than ours. And so maybe true of our ancestors as well. Religion is a dimension of all of life. It is not something that has been segmented out. That alone is worth a lot for us to perceive and understand why. And so when I teach a course and explore this in my courses, we give a good bit of time to this. I said, we're going to talk about this, and we very quickly move beyond the idea of the spirit and power, because we'll be talking about childbearing. We'll be talking about hunting, about courting, about every aspect of ordinary life, because there is where the presence of the spirit is in the midst of life. And that is a part of the thing we have to be aware of. But yet at the same time, Black Elk and others speak here of the realm of the spirit, or the spirit world, a frequent phrase of Black Elk speaks. And you sense that because he is very much in touch with it. It is the real world. It is not another place, another time. And you get that feeling in Black Elk speaks. It is more real, the things that you touch and handle. You see with the eye of the flesh, to borrow a phrase from William Blake, but you see here with the eye of the heart. It requires the discipline of seeing. Therefore, the importance of that whole procedure among Plains people, but other Indian people, well, of the vision quest, that idea of the special eye. In Black Elk speaks, he speaks very much about, a number of times, about a relative of his. He's rather famous. He's a second cousin to Crazy Horse. And if you're in South Dakota, there is a continual project to build that model of Crazy Horse, which we do not have an image of, by the way, but Kozalski, who recently died, who was building that, his family will carry on, known in history as one of those creative spirits, but the enemy, whose powers was used to defeat the United States cavalry. But Crazy Horse was known among his own people as a man of the spirit that is really in touch with these worlds, this realm, like nobody else was. And the Crazy Horse here, the title is not crazy, but a really sort of spirit horse. And I talked about his horse that, and sort of that story that is connected with him, how he got his name. A man who was sort of a loner, because he was in touch with these things, but he was recognized, which is rather rare in Indian communities, of having spiritual powers at a very early age. It is usually only the elders, after much training and much experience, can really share these things. But Crazy Horse is a special case of something that is there often. He had that special way of seeing. In the Sioux realm, and I apologize for this because most of my experience and references will be to the Plains people and particularly toward the Sioux peoples, and I have additional experience in the Southwest and very little depth for reading and very little of that in terms of this part of the country, but I trust what I'll say will relate to that as well. The focus is upon, and I'll use the term, Wakantanka, The Great Mysterious, translated usually by those who came first as the Great Spirit, identified many times with God, the God of our scriptures. But this reality comes under many names. Anthropologists, by the way, have debated for a long, long time, well into the early 19th century, did Indians believe in one God, like Christians and Jews and Muslims do? And I really don't know on that. If you take the technical sense of abstract ideas that have sort of grown in Islamic and Jewish and Christian theology and philosophy, perhaps not. But that's not the issue. And I'd to add that for many Native American communities, the gods, the powers, may be many. But the presence of the powers is everywhere you turn. I know of no Native American community that's sort of described in literature I met personally, it was that sense of the presence. It's not deeply a part of their tradition. And I also know from the Plains people, from contemporary experience, but also the reportings of the experiences from earlier times, that there is a vision or understanding of these powers, of this power, that is very close. Indeed, I'll suggest, informs our own understanding of the way God creates, relates to God's creation. And the thing I'll pick up tomorrow, but all of these topics interrelate with one another, that'll affirm what it means to see the creation in which the gods and the powers are many, that each rock or tree has that power, and each of these is important. When you press a little bit further, all things are one, and they hang together. And that is profound meaning for our understanding, our relationship, our stewardship of creation. Those themes, the reality of that presence that's at the center of things, that all things, you'll find that presence in all things, that presence is there. Some of the things we might learn, some suggestions, and that's just sort of beginning. I have found, in my own context, most of this has been in South Dakota until recent years, a profound and deep heritage of worship and prayer that was already there when our missionary ancestors came. And it enriched the Indian Christians in South Dakota, most of which, by the way, are Catholic or Episcopalian. And several years ago, I visited a Benedictine monk who was a priest in one of our South Dakota reservations, and I said I was coming out, and I'd chat with him, and he said, "You don't want to talk with me, you want to talk with my people." And so my son and I arrived there that day, and he had come waiting for us a variety of people. No Lutherans out in that country, I don't know if that's good or bad. But a Westland Methodist, several Catholics, several Episcopalians, a group of people, and let them talk with you. And they had words of anger and words of insight. We were one. Jesus Christ, they said, makes us one. They had their criticisms of the church, particularly in this case of the Episcopal Church or the pre-Vatican II Catholic Church. And Father Hugh was my host and sort of the neighbor at that point. He is not Indian, but for them he was. And the main thing they wished to share with me and wanted me to hear, before the gospel of Jesus Christ came, we were people of prayer. We know what it means to pray. We know the presence of God. And that is the context in which we praise and honor Jesus Christ as Lord. Some of our missionaries, I've studied the missionary encounter in many ways across the country in one of my areas of interest. And, we should not criticize our forebears because we're not in their shoes, but historically we must see that as well. Our missionary ancestors loved the Indian people, with few exceptions. What they didn't understand, and it's probably true of us as well, did not understand the culture, the ways that are there. And they often saw that the ways that the people had were of Satan. They were pagan. They were heathen. That's the words you don't use in Indian communities, particularly among Indian Christians, that I've dealt with anyway. And they wanted to throw out the old to make room for the new. What I heard from these friends at Marty, South Dakota at that time in the Yankton Reservation is the foundation upon which the Christian faith builds is already here. Deeply rooted and alive, it is in touch with the spirit world. A solid foundation for Christianity, at least that is true among the Indian people of the plains that I've come to know. We do not root it out to replace it, but we learn from it and can build upon it. Some other things from which we can learn. The sense of immediacy, that the spirit world is around us. We sense it. It is present now. If we have eyes to see, eyes of the heart. Or the theme or the concern that that spirit, that presence, which we cannot control, relates to all things, animate and inanimate. That's the theme I'll pick up later. There is no distinction, there's no word for animals, at least in the Sioux language at that point. They are peoples. You have the buffalo people and the eagle people, and you treat them as peoples. They're sort of part of the economy of the relationship. They are citizens, we put in our own language. But that extends beyond that which is animate, because that distinction is not clearly made, if at all. Because the rocks and the streams, they are too alive in touch with Wakantanka. It is a part of life, our calling, to seek the spiritual world. At least in the Sioux or Lakota setting, those powers and the ultimate power that binds them all together are indeed friendly. We must seek that world because that's what will make our people live. This is why we go on to the vision quest, they'll tell me, and that's sort of reviving very much in Lakota communities, among Christian Lakotas as well. Why we participate in the sun dance, that's the meaning of the pipe. I'll say some more about that later on. And finally, these things, jumbled sorts of things, it invites at least me to have a sense of awe. And again, back to the term of respect. Respect for all things around us. And you get that by reading Black Elk Speaks. Everything is filled with what the sense of Wakan, the key word in the language, translated in a variety of ways. It means great, it means mysterious, it means powerful. It is only not some being behind it or around it, but that sort of is expressed in all things. Filled with it, if we would be open to it. Several years ago, Buffy St. Marie, who was a Cree as a part of her ancestry, the Cree Nation of Canada, and one of my favorite folk singers. It was not her own song, it was by Leonard Cohen, but I think she does many of her own songs, but that sort of song captured the things that I want to share. And it was right in the midst, or at the edge the last time, the death of God sort of thing, and she came out with this testimony from Native American experience. God is alive. Magic, in a good sense, is afoot. At that moment, that testimony was given, in which we, out of our own traditions, were sort of questioning that presence. But that's the continual testimony that has come to us. I'll know where that has taken us, but let me open it up there now and to pursue your questions, your experiences, and see what this might mean for us here at Holden Village in these days.
Sense of wholeness and the oneness, the presence of the Spirit. in the early Hebrew thinking, God was the one who was responsible and behind all actions and events, mm-hmm. even those which were perhaps later called evil. And that notion of evil developed later. And I heard what you said about the native world, as native spiritual world, as being termed satanic by some of the early Christians.
Much of the early Christian literature, and that's paradoxical because they love the people, but they have that
right.
cultural sort of set. That
what about the notion of evil in a world where harmony with nature, with the oneness of the world? What is evil like there, or how is what we would describe as evil? How does that fit in?
In most traditions, evil is the lack of balance, mm-hmm. and things are out of kilter. And I think the strongest expression of this comes from the Navajo community in the Southwest, where you have your chant ways and your singing. But I think that is also very true of the plains things, that the primary sort of thing that things go wrong, that things are not in harmony. They're not whole.
Does that gain an identity the way it did for us, almost being even personified, or not? There's no real identity. It's just a matter of being out of harmony or out of...
Well, most Indian traditions have the figure of what anthropologists would call the trickster. And they're the, sort of the early stories of this crazy character. Among the plains people, it's the coyote that's represented to, but there are a variety of other sorts of figures there that a semi-human sort of thing, and he's not of the order of Satan or the devil in that sort of full sorts of sense, but he's like us. Maybe that's scriptural too, I don't know. The trickster is a very humorous sort of thing, and the stories about the trickster are always entertaining, they're always instructive, and they deal with aspects of evil. But I would suggest that figure is, the trigger of disbalance or out of being out of sync, out of harmony, is really the stronger tradition that they're,
Wouldn't it be true that the Indian culture is what we're now talking about as being right-brained or oriental, eastern? Wouldn't they be much more that than the left-brained or, what do you call it, logical kinds of ways of dealing with things, so that the mysticism would be for them? They'd be much more at home with that than, say, the Western thought. And story would be very important. And
story is very important, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it would go along with it. I think in that sense, evil would be different to them than it would be to us, because we have to define good and evil logically, and I think Eastern cultures don't worry so much about that.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think it's basically a cultural thing. Just a footnote of what you shared here, that some of you may have read the writings of Vine DeLoria and some of his early angry books, one of the great writers of our time, by the way. And he had a postscript in this book, Custer Died for Your Sins. And every line has a biting humor in Vine DeLoria. But the Brindy sort of likes himself, and Vine DeLoria has gone through what was then Augustana Lutheran Seminary in Rock Island, in a sort of a special student sort of way. He comes out of an Episcopalian background, several generations on that. But he said, I would like to do it in my next stage. He never did fulfill that. I said, I would like to go back and probably go to Scandinavia, he said, and to study the Old Testament, because he saw the great affinities with the Old Testament stories and meanings and the stories of his own people and meanings. But then after that, I think went in and got law. His father is still in South Dakota. He said, the Lutherans messed my son over. And I think there was not only humor in that, but a sort of sense of pathos, of hurt there as well. But that message of the postscript of that book, that the Hebrew and the experience of his own people in the plains are indeed inform one another. That's an intriguing idea. Yeah?
Could you expand on the Indian's relationship to the animal kingdom? Said something about them viewing animals as other races or other peoples, like buffalo people. Well, how did they relate to these other, other than hunting them? And you see these TV shows, movies about the white buffalo and all that sort of thing.
You relate them in terms of respect, you relate to them in terms of equals. The buffalo in particular is referred to in the plains culture as the elder brother. In many ways, a brother is superior. I mean, the buffalo is superior to you. You recognize that your whole existence is dependent upon the traditional society, upon the buffalo. And therefore, the buffalo becomes a part of the ceremony, the part of the prayers. You do not just hunt the buffalo, but you must give attention to the buffalo, that you ask for forgiveness. You know, this is the part of the harmony that you must take his life, the buffalo's life. But, you know, for us it seems sort of strange, because that is which we live. But there the real meaning is that the buffalo gives himself for us. He sacrifices himself. And it enters into almost all the ceremonies, the buffalo, that figure. Another aspect I want to pick up more later of the animals. This is true of all animals. Some inanimate things as well. In a sense, they are nearer to the spirit world than we are. They are the messengers. And if we are to understand what our calling is, to put in a Lutheran or Christian term at that point, we listen to the voice of the ant or of the wind or of a particular bird, certain animals connected with healing. They have power that human beings do not have. Well, those are just some of the meanings of animals. You know, they're related to them in a kind of a covenant relationship of partnership, a kind of relationship of revelation. It is through the animal world that, to use our term, you know, that, you know, revelation of insight comes. I don't know if that speaks to the question.
Well, it strikes me as odd that it almost sounds sort of a cannibalistic relationship. You know, they would eat animals if they considered equal or superior, yet they would not eat each other. You know, they wouldn't eat their captives.
Yeah.
Kind of odd.
Yeah. No, I wrestle that. I'm not sure that there is some cannibalism among Indian tribes. And,
in a ceremonial sense.
Yeah, as far as I can tell, it's a ceremonial context. Just like scalping, I think, is present here, but that's sort of a religious sort of thing. The real thrust of scalping, by the way, was introduced by Europeans, primarily the Dutch, as bounty hunting, that's another sort of thing, yeah.
How do they, people who are Christians, the Indian people who are Christians, do they keep this background, or how do they relate the background of animal equal, you know, stone, man, object being equal? Then how do they, you know, are we talking about the pure Indian culture, or are we talking about the Christian people who have?
I suggest that many of the important things have remained. And I will see this, and they will tell me that Indian people that have moved off the reservation lived in urban areas. And the important features have gone sort of underground, are still part of their perception of understanding, and it has not been wiped out.
Same thing occurred in the Scandinavian countries when we were all baptized by the sword, in a sense, and Pan went underground, and all of the perception of liveliness of the world is under there. We find it still in contemporary literature, when you read Scandinavian literature. There. There was a novel, I don't remember the author's name, called The Man Who Killed the Deer, which follows the son of the tribe who goes away to the school and then comes back and is out of sync and kills a deer without properly preparing the death or the hunt, and brings all sorts of disharmony into his life and into the life of the people around him because of that. Beautiful piece.
Frank Waters.
Yeah.
Right.
Excellent book. I think it's sort of.
In the New Testament, there's.
Did your question get answered satisfactorily? Before I get Bruce in.
Well, I guess so. I mean, you know, I was just wondering, you know, about how much they kept of the traditional things, and, you know, how they integrated it in with.
I mentioned sort of wide variation of answers on that. You know, I was at a large Indian Christian gathering a couple of summers ago, and I was with our neighbor in Sioux Falls, the Episcopal bishop at that time. And he said, "Be careful, Duane, when you talk about traditional sorts of things, because among our people, tradition means things, you know, 19th century Anglican hymns and so forth. And so that's what that means for them. And, you know, that's, they go back to what their forefathers get, you know, a generation or generation two ago. And so that sort of traditionalism has sort of been replaced. But even there, and he's very much aware that there are patterns of relationship with the earth and with other people that are profoundly there. They've been sort of lightly covered over. even where you don't expect it, it comes back.
In the New Testament, there's some very heavy arguments that take place about not assimilating Jewish traditions such as circumcision or demanding that it be a part of the new Christian faith. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there maybe is a danger existent here in what I hear you saying is an attempt to sort of kind of carry along and accept and maybe even assimilate some Indian traditions into the Christian faith. Are we talking about the same kinds of things here? You know, is it possible to bend over so far to accept Indian tradition and Indian spirituality and incorporate it into the Christian faith that we are sort of doing injustice to those New Testament arguments?
What do you think?
I guess at this point I'm, yeah. You know, a little bit of...
It seems like there's a reverse dynamic there, that the struggle in the New Testament was to have a universal witness and to reach out and to include all people. And the Judaizers were saying, no, you can't become a part of this unless you become first like we are and assume our culture. That was a narrowing of the gospel. In other words, it would be like us saying you can't become a Christian unless first you become Puritan background, English speaking, something else. That's where the New Testament gospel, I think, would speak a word of warning to us. But when you look at the Old Testament, particularly the way that when the people of Israel come to a particular place and they discover that Yahweh really already is known there as God Almighty, or as the God of hosts, or that they've already encountered him some other way, and then God takes on those names. And that was not considered idolatry or syncretism or something else.
In other words, it would be more like Paul's experience with men of Athens. I perceive you are...
Well, that was sarcasm.
Would speak to that too, because I think this is one of the two or three most important theological issues that we face in a world that is very pluralistic in many cultures, and how does the Christian faith relate to this? What dangers there is in sort of bringing in the roots and the basic stuff of other cultures, and how much do we keep separate? I'm concerned. I love the prophets in the Old Testament, and one of the themes that runs through there is you don't become identified with the powers associated with, you know, the agriculture and the land and so forth, and the purity of the faith, you know, the people that come from the desert, for example, is very important, and if we're faithful to that, we must be aware of that danger. You gave part of my answer. I think the New Testament, you know, moves seemingly in another direction at that point. Yeah.
How common was it to create or allow for religious experience, you know, such things on the West Coast as the sweat, fasting, the drugs, you know, was it peyote or some of the things? Was it a common practice for the majority of people to find some way to be involved in an experiential, the spiritual?
You mean part of the church and missionaries, or part?
No, I mean, as far as the Indian culture, did most of their, as an initiation of adulthood or any of those things, did they go through some kind of a spiritual experience? You know, the snakes that you see in some dances, or drugs, or fasting for long periods, or some of those things.
Most, as far as I can tell, had, you know, these rites of passage, particularly the ones into adulthood, and there, you know, varies in culture, community, in terms of the women and the men at that point. For both woodlands and plains people, you know, you do this in an anthropological sort of sense, the vision quest is the primary form in which that enter into that.
So they found some way to experience a vision. I know in California, the Indians we had around the Bishop area, they would build a sweat house, and they would...
And the sweat is very common among them.
Yeah, and somehow in that whole process, they would kind of enter the spiritual world.
Mm-hmm. It's called a sauna.
I'm sure the Finns and the people of northern Sweden, those are spiritual meanings there, and I suspect they're not very different. Yeah, those rites of passage, and it seems among plains people, expected, it varies again, but generally, particularly for all male and sometimes for female, there is the process by which you get your identity, your meaning, and at least the language that I'm familiar with, that your people may live, that your name and your identity is for the well-being of the community.
Kind of attempt to put you in touch with, quote, another spiritual world or another realm
yeah.
of existence.
And I see it, the meaning of that is to is expected time that you would be in touch with this other spiritual realm for the sake of your people. One of the interesting things, and that our students wrestle with it when we deal with it, at the age of 9, Black Elk, as a young boy, has these fantastic experiences, you know, and one of them is a near-death experience. And he does not tell anybody, you know, that, well, isn't that contrary to the experience? And that, it is not until you're, it varies here until the puberty or slightly afterwards, probably in that time it seems to be about 18, and our way of thinking it, that one would be expected under proper guardianship or guidance or mentorship is the word I want to use, that you would have this, and so that he goes through much of that story of having these experiences, a tremendous calling. He's called to save his people. He does not share that with anyone until finally he is so afraid of the thunder beings, particularly that he must tell someone. And then the story unfolds of how he must perform his vision in the presence of the people. It must become common property. And then the whole book is wrestling with a sense of vocation. It's a very dramatic book in that sense, that Nyhard has put it together anyway, that, you know, what vision has for his people. And clearly, it is not an individual thing, but the vision experience is before, you know, for the sake of all of your people. And it must be lived out, yeah.
My wife should live in New Mexico, so we have traveled to Colorado, New Mexico,
yeah.
and everything. And there's a lot of these Indian ruins, and got some of the background history, and of course, as you know, the Navajo and all these still live there. And everything we've ever read or heard about any spirituality or any of the great things going on, of course, the leaders and so forth, and these sweat houses all come in.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, in your study, in your particular, you know, the, I'm not too much up on them. So and so forth. What do they have? What are the women's role in any of this? You know, I just didn't see it in the southwestern Indians that, you know, places
yeah.
that we.
On the sweat, I get different voices on the contemporary experience of the sweat lodge. Most often it's men and women do it separately. And there's a very sort of sense of propriety that's very strong there. But some will say in traditional days it was for men only. More of the people I talked to said it was for men and women that the sweat was there. But it's primarily a male thing, at least in sort of the accounts of the stories.
How do they account for that? I mean, where do they, going back, I mean, I never heard of any, you know, like way back, how did it come that, you know, we blame Mars on the, you know, out of concept, but. How do the Indians, since they don't have that, but...
Yeah. Again, I see variety here, and the Plains people, in most cases, it's a very distinct role between male and female, and most of the accounts that I'm familiar with, in terms of the ritual in particular, in terms of the stories. But a number of Indian communities, the power and the priority belongs to the women. It's true of Navajo people. That's where the power is. You know, they own the sheep, for example, in the modern Navajo society. The Iroquois community on that, the political power is with it, the women, so you have those variations. And I don't know if there's any sort of one simple answer to those things. Very common recurring theme recognized that there are powers unique to women. One of the things, if you've heard some people talk about contemporary Indian ceremonies, one of the first things you do if you have it something sacred, sometimes they'll get rid of all the women. Or sometimes they ask if you're menstruating and they get rid of you. The sort of sense that recurs again and again that the one of the greatest powers in the world is the woman, because she is the one that gives life. And that is power not because it is dirty or evil, because it is so specially powerful. It is the power that you must keep separate from the other kinds of things that you do. And
and the woman, I'll come back to that theme again, participates in the powers of Earth in a special way. Earth is mother. No, that's a dangerous image or not. Because she is fecund, and she is productive. And the models of the woman's propriety, of her role, of her caring, are taken from images of the earth and of growth. And so I could say in summary or general in a way that there are very important places for women, but it is usually distinguished from the role of man. Whether one is superior to another, you know, I think we have, you know, from our perspective, we've judged, I think, most cases that the male seems to have the primary thing, but.
Well, in some of the visions, the woman is the bringer of.
Yeah.
Like a peace pipe.
Yeah, those of you who are familiar with the Plains image of the buffalo calf woman, the most important figure, and it is almost a parallel to Christ. And many Indian people make the connection that the one who brings the wisdom and the instructions here is the woman. She's almost sort of incarnate here. She represents the buffalo calf, and she is the one that bears the pipe, which becomes the primary instrument of prayer, of thanksgiving there. And so that the key figure in story is the woman in that case. And many other legends or creation stories or origin myths, women are very prominent.
Yeah, I'm wondering about in the spirit aspect here, the children. Is there a lot of time spent with the children developing this sort of a way of seeing things?
Very much. At least the stories I know, that the important thing is to teach your children. And most societies, it seems that that is the function of the elders. That education of the children is primarily, in terms of the law and what we would call the spiritual things, or the ways of life, are the responsibility of a generation removed, that they would sort of bear that tradition. Now, a common experience I've had of Indian students that come into my classes, probably the greatest thing I do for them, they go back to Rosebud or Pine Ridge, and they tell me this, that I go back and talk to my grandparents' generation. You know, the grandparents may include aunts, great aunts, and uncles as well, and that society, but that's where the wisdom is. You know, traditionally that was so, but very often their own parents have been sort of divorced from this. It's like Scandinavians when they came over here, you want to give up the old language and the old ways, and that's a nurse in between. But I think it's a much deeper thing, that the wisdom on these matters is with generation, and it is their concern to teach the children.
Do they do that through mostly through conversation, or do they do it through other means?
Conversation, or they the book The Sacred calls it simply lecturing. It's sort of almost a formal sort of thing. But perhaps the more important way is a ceremony. Like the Hebrew accounts, when you have the Passover is an annual event when you teach you who you were, that you were liberated, and God is a liberating God. That each ceremony has associations with of interpretation. That the ceremony is given here with the meanings and the origin of that event. At least in traditional society, these are the ways that spiritual things were made, primarily between the connection with ceremony, the sun dance, for example, or the very individual preparation for the vision quest. I've known young people that have gone the vision quest, or I have a friend of mine who's now preparing again to go in the sun dance. Each of these events is done only under the tutelage of what we would call a mentor or a spiritual guide, one who has gone the route before. And then they would instruct in the proper preparation, the materials to guide, the attitudes to have, the fasting is an important part of all the sorts of things.